Blog Talk Radio.
How you doing? Check this out. Wait a minute. Do not, I repeat, please do not change the channel. You know why? Because this is Taino Radio. That's right. We're back. It's Tuesday. Lenny Lenape territory is June 29th. Very hot, muggy.
Yo, this is Sana Gordy, Taino Radio. Natalie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I lost you for a minute, but we're good now, I think.
Oh, listen, this is, let me give you a backdrop of this for all you listeners out there as well. Last night we had a show on Does Hell Exist? And we had some crazy stuff going on in the studio last night. And guess what? I guess we got
some residue.
Left over.
So oh man!
Any listeners out there? I just want you to do one final thing. If you have any tabonuco, any sage, anything around alcoholado, please take it out. Send it to tainoradio.com because there's some crazy stuff going on, right?
Oh man! Now I'm nervous. Should I even talk?
No, you're cool. You're cool. What's going to happen is if we get cut off, just don't panic. There's this studio. I don't know if it's the humidity in the air or it's actually hell getting burning, you know.
Yeah, it's feeling kind of like hell these days, isn't it?
I know, but it's crazy. It's ever since we started that show. And because of this, it's amazing. It's never happened before, first time that. Even though we're talking, right?
Right.
Oh, I think we're losing it here.
Oh no!
I've lost total control of the studio, so it's kind of ironic that we're still online. Totally lost control of the studio.
Oh man, yeah, I can hear you, but I don't know what's going on with the show.
Well, we'll try our best. This is out of control. Let me see if I can put the chat room on. Maybe the chat will work. Let's see. Let me see if I... Nope. I literally have no control of... Hold on a second. Oh, yes, I do have control of the chat. Okay. But I got no control of music or anything. Isn't that something?
Oh, no.
Never happened before.
Bummer.
But considering all of this... This is the Indigenous Caribbean Study Hour with Natalie Huber Rodriguez.
Yeah, you got it perfectly that time.
Hey, man, it's practicing. You're our resident anthropologist. This is awesome. And technically, this is an open mic night. Open mic. Anyone can ask questions. But before we hit the mics, check it out. I want to thank a lot of these countries that have been tuning in. I'm doing an alphabetical order. You know, there's Argentina, and then we have Australia, Canada, Dominican Republic. Actually, Dominican Republic is in fourth place. It's moving up.
Sweet.
They're actually in fourth place. A lot of the Quisqueyanos.
Quisqueya.
Listen.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're listening, man. And then we got number five, we got Germany. Check that out, Germany. And we have India. Oh, I kind of messed this up last night. India. Then we have Ireland. We got, did I say Italy? Italy.
No, not yet. Yeah, you're good.
Hold on. And Jamaica's with us, still with us, hanging in tough, Jamaica.
Yamaka.
And then we have Jamaica, yeah. We have Japan. All right. I believe one of their hotels has a huge semi three-pointer in Japan.
That's
Mexico.
Awesome.
Yeah, one of the sacred lands, Mexico. Morocco's been with us for over a year, year and a half. Let me see what else here. We got Norway. And we have Portugal. Yeah, what happened to Spain? But we got Portugal. We have Portugal.
We were hating on them too much, maybe.
Yeah, that's it. That's it, man. We got Turtle Island.
On their ancestors, anyway.
Is, yeah, I know, right? That's it. We got Turtle Island, a.k.a. United States of America. And we have 15, 16. Where's 16? Where are you? Oh, Borinquen, Puerto Rico. Yeah, always in second place. And I'm looking for another one. Where is it? I think I said it more. United Kingdom. Okay. Some Tainos out there in United Kingdom. And we have, I think that's it. Yeah, we named them all. It's, oh, how can I forget? Russia. Russia's been with us. There's some Tainos out there in Russia. I want to know where they're at, man.
Yeah.
If there's any Russians listening, well, I guess we got to do a morning show. I guess they're downloading the show. But thank you all you listeners. Yep, thank you all you listeners for downloading the shows. This is amazing. And all you live listeners as well. I know who you are. So here we go. This is the, I have no control of the studio, which is amazing. So I got the chat open so anyone can write in Facebook or can go to the website, I should say, blogtalkradio.com, Guasavara 1491. Let me see. And they can type in any stuff they want. Hold on, I got someone. Hold on a second.
All right.
I think I got, hold on. This is incredible. I lost control of the studio. It never happened to me.
You summoned something last night.
Some residue from.
Right. Residual energy, I think they call it.
God, I know. But you know what? I know in my travels to the Caribbean, they always mention about the brujos, you know, in a very negative way, right? What is that all about, the brujo, brujería? They always talk about it in a bad way, you know? And
yeah,
it sounds like a lot
prefer,
of our medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would prefer talking about our, I think, that, I mean, the word brujo, bruja, I mean, it's witch, basically, right? So, and even that, the word witch has, like, a negative connotation in the English language, right? So mm-hmm. I always like to say, and I think a lot of people I know who practice that tradition go by the term curandero or curandera. I don't know if it's the same in Puerto Rico, but that's at least in Cuba, that's how they do it. And they prefer to go by that than bruja.
Yeah, they always mentioning. I've heard curanderos. I heard of gente que soban, you know, the massage people. You know,
right.
There's actually songs about that. You know, to be careful. Don't send your wife. This Hibaro song. Don't send your wife to the massage person. You know, the massager.
Yeah. That's fair enough.
So I'm trying to look at my notes here, and yeah, I've lost control of the studio. I have no control of music. I have no control of connections. But if anyone wants to try it, it's 515-602-9792, 515-602-9792. Man, I got disconnected. I don't know how I got back in. Well, here I am. I can't believe it. I lost total control of my studio, and we're talking. So
yes.
I have no clue
Are we still on the air?
I have no clue. I think we're in the air because
okay.
It's recording, I believe, but I have no control of the studio, which is crazy. It says that the host is disconnected, but you can hear me, right?
I can, yeah.
Yeah, this is a full spooky loose fault, you know, bringing up the whole question
yeah,
about
yeah.
Hell, what's going on? Well, you know what? Let's keep it going.
All righty. Yeah, we'll do what we can.
You have any experience with that? You got any experience in Native American folklore, mythology, or you know, Caribbean understanding of hell in the indigenous
way? With hell? Okay. You know, I if we're talking about hell, I always think of the Christian, like, I mean, hell is a very Judeo-Christian
right.
concept, right?
There you go. Yep.
I mean, yeah, and actually the word hell comes from the Nordic people. Helheim was the place that was basically, it was underground, so, you know, that makes most sense. It was underground, and it was where the race of a lot of the more the less favorable creatures came from. It was where kind of the giants and more kind of monstrous mm-hmm. creatures resided, and the mm-hmm. person who reigned over it was the goddess Hel, H-E-L, or Hela, as it's sometimes pronounced,
mm-hmm.
And she's shown up in a lot of the new Marvel movies and everything too, even as under the name Hela. But the difference was, big difference between the Judeo-Christian hell and the original Nordic hell is that theirs was frozen, like completely frozen, because to them, you know, living in Scandinavia, the worst kind of weather they ever got was when it was super, super cold, snowy, sub-zero temperatures. So naturally, they're going to think, okay, well, the worst place you could ever go, right, is a place that feels like that. Whereas it, in the Judeo-Christian concept of hell, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition came out of the Middle East mainly, right? So desert and heat, and that's where the concept of hell kind of turned to fire and brimstone, because they're, again, it's the climate that they lived in, and the worst weather condition for them would be, unlike Scandinavia, where everything freezes, and not only do people freeze to death, but crops get destroyed, livestock dies, it's a famine, and it's a miserable time for everyone. So it's kind of the opposite from where the Middle East was. It's, if there's a super, super hot season with drought, again, your crops are going to die, your livestock are going to die, people are going to starve, and it's a miserable time. So that's where the concept of hell comes from. I don't know if you guys, you and Spooky Lou, talked about that, but so whenever I think of hell, you know, I think of it in the Judeo-Christian concept, because that's what it is, and it's meant to be a place where sinners are punished, right, to be reserved for the bad people. And I guess the concept in Christianity, of course, is if you are a bad person in life, you suffer for it in hell, whereas if you're a good person, you go to heaven. And people have done extensive research on hell, or extensive writing, rather, research into the history of it, all the concept of the nine circles of hell and what type of sin they're each reserved for and what the punishment is, et cetera, et cetera. If you ever read, like, Dante's Inferno or anything, it gets real complex. So what I've always come across in Native, a lot of Native American tradition or American Indigenous tradition, but also in just other non-Christian or pre-Christian traditions, is there really is no concept of hell in the same way as it is portrayed in the Judeo-Christian tradition. There is always, though, the closest thing I would say is that there is an underworld, you know, among, and it's called different things, right? For the Aztecs, it was called Mictal, which is land of the dead. For the Maya, it was called Xibalba. There, a lot of other indigenous people have this concept of like a subterranean underworld that is not necessarily, though, where bad people go for punishment, right? It's quite literally just a land of the dead. It's where the dead people go. That's what, at least in the central, the Mesoamerican traditions, it is. It's not any good or bad. It's where everybody goes. And that concept was also true for the Greek and Greco-Roman tradition. You know, they had an underworld as well. And again, it was not a place of punishment. It probably wasn't the most fun place to be, but it was a place where pretty much everybody went. And it wasn't about, you know, evil versus good or punishment of sin or anything like that. But it's funny, the whole idea of something underground, you know, whereas in some traditions we have this concept of the underworld for certain indigenous groups, and that's where people go when they die. Yet a lot of other groups, indigenous groups, feel that is where we as humans and a lot of the natural world and the animals came from, right? Came from underground, okay. From under the earth.
That's right.
And I just think that's an it. Yeah, even like in Taino tradition, right? We believe we came out of the caves. Caves is where we started. Caves are another subterranean atmosphere, right? Environment. We are coming out from under the ground. Right. We are born from the earth, right? That is, the earth is mm-hmm. Atabe, is the mother, the fertile mother. So it makes sense that we come from the ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting dichotomy, I feel like, because, you know, we talk about, you may have heard, like, there's a saying of, oh, we come from the ground and we return from the ground, because that really is the truth. And I think a lot of these indigenous American, but also pre-Christian mm-hmm. traditions in other parts of the world, Europe and what have you, also recognize that, too. Like, even the ancient Sumerians believed that when we died, we all went back into the earth as well. So I think mm-hmm. that it's a mixture of people, again, associating the earth with being the beginning and end of all things, right? And everything is connected. Everything is circular. So again, especially in indigenous American tradition, we come from the earth and we return to the earth. And I think that's something that is pretty universal across a lot of indigenous cultures and others as well. So mm-hmm. hell, in terms of a fiery or a place of punishment, a place of, you know, where people go to, those who are evil go to face for their actions in the afterlife. I've really not seen that, at least in my studies of indigenous cultures across the Americas. It just, I don't know if that was because the concept of, you know, these great sins that everyone could commit didn't really exist yet, because the concept of sin itself is again a colonist construct, right? It's what the Europeans mm-hmm. and their Christian religion kind of pushed on. They said, oh, you're sinners because of XYZ. But, you know, we didn't really have that idea. Like, we didn't have the idea that, oh, if you do this, it's a sin, you do that, it's a sin. I mean, I think there was some general laws of, yes, it's bad to murder, to steal, to rape, etc. But again, it was in such a completely different context. And from what I've heard mm-hmm. and studied, a lot of indigenous cultures had their own ways of punishing those who, I guess, transgressed whatever particular rules their community had within themselves. You know, they didn't think they didn't have to worry about, oh, well, they'll get punished for it in the afterlife. They took care of it while they were still alive, right? As long as they were able to identify who had ever done it. I was reading that, like, in some of the Algonquin and Longhouse group, the Iroquois groups, if a man was found to be guilty of rape, he was beaten brutally by, like, all the other men in the group, and he was in some cases castrated and in some cases exiled altogether from the community, so he could never come back. So I'd say that, you know, I mean, and it's funny because, you know, that seems like, yeah, that seems an appropriate punishment, whereas in European Christian mindset, really, rape was I don't think even a sin, not on the list of great sins, right? Because it was always the woman's fault. The women were the temptresses and the ones who were inherently more evil. So if a man rapes a woman, it's not a thing. It's not anything that anyone really seeks out any punishment for. It's just the way it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I have a question for you. You know,
sure.
As a Bahike, I'm constantly trying to teach my apprentices as much traditional Taino, you know, history and what was passed down. Now there's different levels, like there's plant medicine that definitely has survived since 1492. Then there's different ceremonial that hasn't really survived per se. So there's a lot of reconstruction with that. But
right.
There is something in chapter 18 in the Relación of Fray Ramón Pané. He talks about the Bejique failing in a healing ceremony and the patient dying and how the family reacts to that. Can I just share can I just read from chapter 18? And I want to get your opinion on it.
Yeah.
All right. This is right after the patient dies, okay? Hold on a second. And, okay. How the dead man's relatives avenge themselves when they have had, some of this grammar's kind of, the translation is kind of rough here. How the dead man's relatives avenge themselves when they have had a reply through the sorcery of the potions. So the dead man's relations assemble on a certain day and lie in wait for the said Bojique. Give him such a thrashing that they break his legs, arms, and head and leave him for dead.
Oof.
At night, they say, there come many different kind of snakes, white, black, green, and many other colors, that lick the face and whole body of the Bojique, whom the Indians have left for dead. This they do two or three nights in succession, and presently they say the bones of his body knit together again and mend, and he rises and walks rather slowly to his home. Those who meet him on the road say, "Were you not dead?" He replies that the Semis came to his aid in the shape of snakes, and the dead man's relish. And the dead man's relations, very angry and desperate because they thought they had avenged the death of their kinsmen, again try to lay hands on him, and if they catch him a second time, they pluck out his eyes and smash his testicles. But say no amount of beating will kill one of these Bojiques if they do not first tear out their testicles. Oh, snaps. Now, here we go. How the dead man whom they had turned, how the dead man whom they have burned reveals what they wish to know and how they take their vengeance. When they uncover the fire, the smoke rises until it is lost from sight. And when it leaves the furnace, wow, it's a hint on hell, right? It makes a chirping noise. I didn't even know that. It makes a chirping noise. Then it descends and enters the hut or the bohio of the Bojique or the doctor. If he did not observe the diet, he falls sick that very moment. Is covered with sores, and his whole body peels.
Oof.
This they take for a sign that he did not observe his diet, and so they try to kill him in a manner described above. These are the sorceries they perform. What do you think about all that? That's a pretty. I've been studying that for years now.
That's intense. That's a lot of information. Very detailed, very graphic. So
what is going on?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just trying to figure out. So they tried to kill him, but he came back to life, and then they tried to kill him again. Is that what happened?
That's what it seems like. Yeah, but the first time the snakes came.
Right, right. But the second time, does it say what they did? If they were able to kill him or not the second time?
It seems like when they uncover the fire, they burn him. Wait. How the dead man whom they have burned, okay, they burn him,
right,
reveals that they wish to know. So he was alive. And how they say their vengeance. So they, when they uncover the fire, the smoke rises until it lost from sight. And when it leaves the furnace, it makes a chirping noise. Okay, then it descends and enters the bohio or the bohique. If he did not observe the diet, he falls sick that very moment.
And he did
fall
sick.
Oh, so the fire is like poisoning him. It's the fire that's poisoning him, no?
Right.
Know.
It's revealing that he didn't follow the diet or... Right.
Right. And it's covered with sores and his whole body peels.
So he got...
Take for a sign that he did not observe his diet.
The diet.
And so they try to kill him in the manner described above. Huh.
Which I'm assuming is the when they remove the eyes and the and smash the testicles, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
That is a rough way to go.
It seems like the Bahika had a hard job.
Yeah, it does. You know, I do feel bad for the guy. you got it. I mean, he went
no
through a lot,
for error.
Right? So again, you as a Bahike, I am not a Bahuti or anyone,
right.
You know, in that, like, of course I learn from other Bahike and spiritual leaders, and I try to follow the practice, but I'm not, you know, as connected to it as you are. But I feel like there's a couple things going on here, because obviously we know, healing didn't always work, right? It was sometimes it does, hopefully, and when it doesn't, it's usually there's also a medical reason for it, but also as a Bahike or other spiritual leader of an indigenous group, you would say there's some kind of spiritual element at play too, right? As to why it didn't work, like why. It was just like it wasn't meant to be. It's along those lines, right?
Right, exactly.
So
go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was just saying what it sounds like to me is the Bahike at first when it sounds, you know, he tries to heal this man, but unfortunately it doesn't work. And the family is understandably upset, you know, of course, as you would be. I mean, my father died of a stroke 2 years ago, and, you know, he was taken to the hospital. Yeah, so he was taken to the hospital, and, you know, the doctors and everything, they tried to treat him, but it didn't work. It failed. They couldn't help him, and I felt that anger, you know, that like wanting to blame someone, right? I know it's not right, and I know it's not fair to do that, but in that moment, when you lose someone who you love, and you feel like this has to be someone's fault, right? We always, as humans, I feel like, look for a source of blame. And in my mind, I was like, well, what did you guys do or not do? I mean, we left him with you in your care, you were supposed to fix this, to help this, and you didn't, and it's like, that's your job, isn't it? Why did you fail to do your job? And so to me, at least, that's what it seems like the reaction of the relatives was when they originally went after that Bahike, because they're grief-stricken. But then there's also this, you get this sense of kind of distrust or this suspicion, right? Because you're like, well, if this is a true powerful Bahike, why wasn't he able to do this? And I thought the same thing. I said, well, this is supposed to be one of the best hospitals. These doctors are supposed to be the best. So what the hell happened here? and you yeah. again, you blame people. You don't think about the bigger picture of it, in some cases, the medical reasons, but also the spiritual reasons. And you just say, this person didn't do their job or what we wanted them to do, right? And so, therefore, they must be a fraud, or they can't, they're not up mm-hmm. to the task somehow. So that's what it seemed like to me. They were acting out on that. But clearly, mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like he was the true Bejike, or else the Femi would not have come to his aid, right? That's just
right.
my interpretation. You can speak to it better. But then what confuses me is
sure.
the later part about the diet, when they say, okay, as a Bejike, he's supposed to follow the strict diet, and if he doesn't, if he hasn't been, he's going to fall ill. It almost seems like it was like a test of his to see if he was a true Bejike, if he was, you know, right for that calling. And the fact that he did fall ill, which suggests that, oh, well, he didn't follow the true Bejike's diet. So was he really a true Bejike, or was he, you know, what's the word? I'm sorry, I'm blanking. An amateur at his, or not really meant for that particular calling, or what's going on there? That's how I see it. There's a lot of ambiguity there. I mean, you're the Bejike. You tell me what you think in all this, because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff going on. The thing that strikes me the most is the snakes. I like that, about the snakes come and lick him.
Right.
So it seems like the snakes have this medicinal power. It's white,
right.
White, black, green, and many other colors. Interesting. And they lick the face and the whole body of the Bejike, who they leave for dead. So it's interesting how they said that the Semi came to help. They said the Semis came. So I'm looking at definitely look at how the spirit world comes to the assistance of the Bejike.
Right.
So there's a
That's
connection there.
Right.
There's a deep connection to the spirit world, and also the diet. There's a connection also to the physical world, that you have to follow a certain diet.
Right. This
is very important. So there's two rules there. The physical health of the Bejike, that he follows a strict diet, certain protocols. And then there's that spiritual element, that there's a relationship, you know, both the physical and the spiritual. And
absolutely, yes.
Yeah, and I guess this is an extreme way of showing the story. That
yeah,
ceremony.
Yeah, because it has it all.
Yeah, yeah, that ceremony should be taken seriously, you know, should be taken very seriously. And if the Bejike is not prepared, he should
Things
not
can
be,
go wrong. Yeah.
Right. He should not be curing. Don't do any ceremonies, because it lets the people down.
Right.
The family
right.
down. So I guess what
right.
I'm getting, just listening to you too, and just knowing like Native peoples throughout the Americas, North America, that they take ceremony very, very seriously. You know, there's sense of protocols.
Of
There's what do you call that? Lineage, you know, who taught
mm-hmm.
you this, you know, and where did he get this from? It's very, very important.
Right.
And now with all these controversies about like ayahuasca, like people charging money, there's unions in South America, all these unions, and if you're not part of the union, you can't perform these ceremonies. So
right.
I can see
ayahuasca tourism is a whole industry.
Yeah, exactly. So I see how there's that test almost, you know, like, you know, if you're
right.
really a Bejike, if you're really who you are, you know, you're gonna pass these tests. You know,
right.
But it seems like the people were shocked in this moment, because he came back to life. They're like, hey, wait a minute.
Right, right. Which is, you know, mm-hmm. is a sign in his favor, right? Because you know,
yeah.
that shows that obvious connection to the spirit world, right?
Right. Yep, exactly. And then that physical world, in the sense of those, you know, the whole potency of, you know, semen bringing life,
right?
That whole life, the role of the male in the village to bring children, and how that's like the worst thing I guess you could do to a man, right? This is destroying his manhood. But
exactly.
Then again, I think this is an extreme way of showing you better know your shit, man. If not, you're gonna pay. You know what I mean? So I'm saying that they're taking this seriously.
If the physical world doesn't get you back, the spiritual world will.
Right. So I was just curious, you know, of your knowledge of mythology. Because I tell my apprentices, you know, you got to take this seriously. You just can't make stuff up, show up to a ceremony and thinking that, you know, whoa, you know.
You know,
focus,
everything,
focus,
yeah.
You know?
Right. Absolutely. And that, you see that in a lot of, I mean, you know, I was thinking of you know, the myth of Prometheus who kind of defies Zeus.
Yes.
I don't know if you know the story. He defies Zeus, right? And he gets punished by being chained to a rock and have that eagle come and eat his liver every night. But yet somehow it always grows back and he's still alive. So it's like he's coming back from the dead pretty much every night. But he still, you know, he went against a higher power, you know, and so he did have to be punished for that. But it shows that there's still some kind of connection that he has, or else why would he keep coming back to life? Why would he keep surviving every night when the eagle eats his liver and then it regrows and he's okay.
Well, how about Yaya'el, you know?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Fish. Yaya'el, the story of
the
son of Yaya'el, right? That he's punished for being disobedient to Yaya. He's killed, but then he comes back to life as a fish, right? It's fish.
Right.
Fish and water.
Right.
So all of these connections, right?
Absolutely. There's a lot of... I think in mythology and folklore, this idea of, you know, someone who kind of gets a little too prideful, as they say it, or steps, you know, claims to be something they're not, kind of, what's the word, like, shoots above their mark, really, or tries to again, they go against a higher spiritual power in that way by through pride or through making false claims, and they're punished somehow by that higher power, you know.
Right. Wow. I mean, it's deep, man.
So,
we're going way back into the history of the thing, you know, right?
Right. But I know that's right, and it's a lot of you know, a lot there. You see that through a lot of mythology throughout the Americas. But also through, a ton of folk tales and myths from all over the world come to mind. Again, it's meant to show that, you can't go around thinking you know better than the gods, the spirits, or the people with true spiritual power, claiming to be more powerful than you are,
exactly.
You know, giving these false claims or... practicing ceremonies you shouldn't be practicing, or leading ceremonies, even worse, that you shouldn't be leading. It's something I feel like it's meant to sort of, I feel like, from a bigger picture perspective, to kind of remind us to check ourselves, you know. I guess it would be the modern term, like, keep yourself in check, be humble, be respectful, be humble. Know that you can always learn, and you're not, you know, you don't know it all. You don't, and always make sure that you are committing and devoting and taking things seriously, and not just going half-assed at it, right? I mean, that's how I take it. I know for me, like a lot of people in my Taíno community, like for ceremony, they don't want you, nobody is supposed to have anything in their system like several days before. So obviously no drinking, no recreational drugs, no marijuana. You know, you're not supposed to have any outside substances in you before ceremony, because it interferes with it, right?
Right.
So, I mean, that's what I always make sure I do. You know, even before I go to like a powwow or something, like obviously, you know, you're not supposed to bring any drugs or alcohol to a powwow in general, but I don't participate. I don't have a drink or anything that whole weekend or several days before, even just to get myself in the right place for ceremony and for a spiritual experience, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes you need some good smokes, you know?
What'd you say?
Yeah, sometimes you need some good smokes, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, yeah. Like, you know, obviously tobacco, everything, that's because that's sacred. But, you know, I remember someone in my community at one point when I was at a ceremony, a few of the younger people had been smoking a little weed and, you know, whatever. That's normally okay. But then one Kasike was like, well, no, you can't participate in ceremony then tonight because you're high. I mean, and you're high through a ceremonial way. You did this as a recreational altered state of consciousness as opposed to like a spiritual ceremonial one, as we would do with other substances, like what we've talked about, like ayahuasca or something, you know, that's different than just going and smoke, you know, lighten up a joint or something. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's different protocols to all this. So it's important that we respect that. We respect the lineage. We respect medicine, you know, and also definitely respect the client, the patient who's receiving it, because it can bring harm or even death.
Of course.
So that's right.
Yes, God forbid.
Yeah, you got to be real careful. That's why we avoid certain things. Huh? What was that?
Right, but yeah, and I feel like as a Bahike, you know, yourself, it's a big responsibility, right? It's a lot on you because then you always do have people, you know, anybody who is a Bahike or Bhoti or anything is the intermediary between the physical and the spiritual world, right? That's a
definitely,
big and probably the most important job.
Definitely, that's life and death, too, because I know sometimes it causes the death of the medicine person when they do their thing, you know?
Right.
And
it's risky to both parties. It's risky to both parties, I always think. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where if something doesn't go quite right or things aren't protocol and procedure isn't followed, like, to the letter and, God, you know, something goes wrong, God forbid, then... You know, it's people are going to look at the Bahike, right?
Yeah. You know, I remember many years ago, I worked in hospice care for 17 years as a social worker, and I had one family in particular who were in their 50s. The wife was in her 50s, the husband was like in his 60s, and he had a chronic heart condition. At any minute, he was going to die. The heart was just going to stop. And eventually, that's what happened. The heart stopped, and he died. But the wife looked very healthy, you know. All of a sudden, she got this news from the doctors, her doctors, that she had this chronic renal failure now. They had to do emergency procedure, and eventually she was put on, dialysis. Like three times a week or four times a week, and she was the only caregiver for the patient. So talking about like stressors, you know, and I remember having to do counseling for her, and she just could not believe how she got this renal failure. I said, "What happened? What did they say?" Because she was very thin too, you know, she wasn't overweight. And she says, it's these pills I've been taking like for 30 years now for my hypertension. It caused my kidney failure. It caused kidney failure. I can't believe these doctors gave me these pills
that killed
my kidneys. My kidneys are shot. So I remember she was like in shock. Like she trusted these doctors, you know, all these years.
Right,
like, take this pill and you're going to have, you know, you'll avoid a stroke or you'll avoid a heart attack, you know.
Right, but they don't tell you.
Well, now she has renal failure. Like,
right.
Her husband needs her.
Oh, God.
She, you know, so eventually she died as well. afterwards.
Oh,
you know?
That's horrible.
Yeah, I think part of it too, she got so depressed, you know.
I'm sure, yeah. I mean, you know, mental, psychological, and physical health is all connected,
yeah.
right?
So,
what I feel like. It's like, you know, we talk about
mm-hmm.
medical malpractice and everything because and
mm-hmm.
why it's such a – people get so upset about it, rightfully so, is because, yeah, you put your lives in the hands
mm-hmm.
of these people and you trust
yeah.
them. And then when something goes wrong that turns out to be because of an error on their part or a mistake on their part, it's this total, you know, like you lose all faith
yeah.
in everything, right? I mean, you say, God, I put the
yeah.
life in my hands of this person who was supposed to take care of me, and they ended up doing something worse maybe or making it so – I can imagine there might be a similar kind of relationship when you're doing any kind of medicine or healing with the Behike or a holy person or a shaman,
yeah.
whatever culture you're in, and something similar happens.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, why shouldn't you feel the same way? You know, especially if you
uh-huh.
discover it through negligence on the part of the person who's supposed to be helping you.
Yeah, definitely. You gotta really be careful. You know, do no harm.
Right.
That's the physician's oath. Do no harm.
Of course.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
happens. So,
and,
I think
you know, you
glimpse.
Being in the healthcare field, I'm sure you're very you
yeah.
have you've got both perspectives, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's why it's do no harm. And sometimes we're talking about people who are suicidal. Even you got certain protocols you follow. And it's just like, wow, it's tough.
Yeah.
I can see this story is like an extreme way of showing that our ancestors really took this seriously. It wasn't like, took it seriously. And also death was taking, like, wow, man, a loss. They really felt the loss, right, of a relative that they're
right.
going to take revenge, right? Like,
right, yeah.
Like, you killed, so I could... Maybe that didn't happen. Definitely, I don't think it happened like that. But it's just what do you call it? It's definitely a story, but behind it all, right? Like mythology, right? What's the meaning behind it all?
Right. And again, we're getting it from one perspective. You know, we don't know what exactly. We don't know. Was this Behike, neglecting his duties as a Behike? Did he make an error, or was it? Was it more of a, the person was just, it wasn't meant to be. There was a spiritual reason for why the patient or the man he was treating ended up dying. We don't know. But what I think is interesting, too, you mentioned the snakes before. And snakes I have always been associated with medicine in a lot of cultures. And I always think that's so interesting, like, because, there, even if you look at the medical symbol with that thing with the wings and those snakes wrapped around the staff, that
You're
is
right.
very, it has a lot of symbolic meaning. And that's because in the ancient world, a lot of the times, from what I've read, the snakes are associated so much with medicine, which a lot of people think is strange because, the snakes can be deadly. But they also, there's this kind of spiritual element to them, right? And what I've heard a lot of the time is that the concept of picking a snake up off the ground is a sort of way of defying death, because you're picking up a snake from where, you're doing almost the impossible and the unnatural, because snakes are always meant to be on the ground, right? They have no legs. They are meant to be on the ground. And if you're able to pick one up off the ground and stay alive, you're defining death in a way. And you see that a lot in a lot of mythology and stories, like even, the story of Hercules when he was a baby, he was able to pick up those two snakes and strangle them before they could kill him. And like I mentioned, the medical symbol of those snakes on there. So I think it's interesting that even in Taino lore and everything, again, when it comes to healing and medicine, you see the snakes again. They're always there.
Exactly. Like, I read somewhere
many years ago, and I lost my source, that the snake represents Hatabe, or the Earth Mother, because it's closer to
right.
the ground.
Right.
So,
and, you know, again, in the like in the pre-Christian world and in the indigenous people of the Americas and even pre-Christian people throughout Europe and other parts of the world, I think we're able to recognize the spiritual significance snakes had because they're so unusual, right? I mean, they're
right.
they're the closest to the ground of any other creature, but they also they have no arms and you know they don't look like anything else. And I think
right.
that's what people associate why they were associated as being so powerful. And then later with Christianity, obviously the snake became associated with the devil. From the old, from the Old Testament, the Garden of Eden and the snake, and the idea
right.
that the snake is so unnatural because, oh, look at it. It doesn't look like any, it's differences that were once celebrated for making it powerful were now reviled and people were disgusted by it. And it was associated with evil and negativity and the devil. So it's just interesting to see, you know, that evolution of what the snake used to mean and then what it's become to mean, but what it's still, we still see it in imagery everywhere, right? It is such a symbolic creature, but I've definitely seen it used in a lot of imagery and symbolism for healing and medicine.
Mm-hmm. Quick question. Do you know about the Greco-Roman tradition or mythology? Is the snake considered bad or evil?
No, that's what I was. That's where the
sorry,
snake,
I
like
part.
I said
uh-huh.
in. No, I was saying the concept of snakes and serpents and being able to pick up snakes off the ground was considered a way of defying death, which is what associated it with. With medicine, right? Because when you treat and you use medicine and healing, you're defying death. So people who are able so the idea of picking up a snake off the ground, you know, doing the unnatural, removing the snake from its natural habitat and picking it up and remaining unharmed, because, you know, snakes could be dangerous, was considered the very essence of medicine, because it's what you do to it's how you that's what you do when you're doing medicine, right? You're defying death.
Oh, man. You know what's interesting? When I took Hebrew scriptures when I was in a seminary, when I took, 101, first thing we learned, chapter 1, the book of, chapter 2, I forget now, the book of Genesis, they talk about the Adam and Eve and the serpent, you know?
Right, right,
and
yeah.
In the Hebrew
and of course
tradition.
Yeah,
tell me.
No, I was saying, go ahead, I was saying, yeah, and of course the snake in Genesis is supposed to be like a representation of evil, right?
Right. Well, in the Hebrew interpretation, which originally comes from, right, the Christians adopted
right.
that, the snake represents knowledge, and it was knowledge that was given to Eve, the woman, she accepted the knowledge. So in the Hebrew is knowledge, not evil. So somehow evil got put in there for the Christian community, but it wasn't from the Hebrew community, which blew my
right.
mind when
yeah.
I first learned this.
Wow.
All you Christian
yeah,
listeners
that's...
out there, I think it's important to research because, you know, the original Genesis story, which is Hebrew, right, was changed. The narrative was changed in the Christian tradition, so. Yeah, it's really important to know that. But I remember when I learned that,
yeah.
I blew, and I asked a professor, are you angry that the Christians did this? He says, well, I don't know, at least they're using it. That's what he said. At least they're using the scriptures, the Hebrew
yeah,
scriptures.
I mean, it's fair, though,
so
because
I'm
it's
like, wow.
yeah, it's not, and again, you need knowledge for medicine and healing, right? So it's all connected,
yes.
but it's it's funny how the concept of knowledge gets twisted to become evil. Like, it's like, you know, no, you shouldn't
and it, learning and knowledge and all that and questioning things is bad. We should stay away from that, right? Like that, or that's at least what the early early Christianity was trying to teach was no, you just accept things the way they are. So, and you don't seek knowledge.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, yeah, because right, exactly. So, man, this is great. I mean, turn into mythology kind of, or looking into the ancient tradition, ancient stories, right? Trying to make sense
right.
of it.
Right, and
it's not
yeah,
easy.
And snakes. Mm-hmm. I mean, snakes show up in in places like Haiti and everything, where people mixed with sub-Saharan African people. The snake was very important to them. They believed the snake was kind of like connected the heavens to the earth. They believed the snakes would take form of a rainbow and they would connect the heavens to the earth. And in like voodoo tradition in Haiti, Damlala, the snake god, is very important for all sorts of ceremonies, but healing ceremonies especially. In ancient Peruvian tradition, the mother goddess is Pachamama, who is a snake as well, like we were talking about Atabe being a snake too. So this idea of a snake mother is seen there. And in the ancient Minoan culture, there's the statue of a snake goddess. And again, it's a very famous statue that was found a while ago. And again, she's picking up she's got her arms raised and she's holding two snakes, like picking them up off the ground. And her cult became associated with healing too, because again, that concept, like what I was saying, of picking a snake up off the ground became the concept, the symbol for defying death through medicine.
Well, I have a question. Last question of the night.
Yeah.
Haitian voodoo religion practices, they use the snake, right?
Mm-hmm. All the time. There's a book called The Serpent and the Rainbow, and they made a movie out of it, too, that's all about Haitian voodoo.
Now, here's my question. Most of the slaves that came over were very young boys, or women, girls, 14, 15 years old. You know, it wasn't the older men. Probably the older men were the shamans or the medicine people. So where did they get this knowledge about the snake? Did they get it from the Taino? Since the snake was considered the saving power that helped this that he can